When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Owen Jones. Welcome to the podcast. Today, Will Young, obviously a very, very celebrated singer. We talked today, he's an author as well, would you believe? And his book, To Be a Gay Man, brilliant read. We talk, and by the way, I have to emphasise, if you're not LGBTQ, you're going to get a lot out of this. This isn't just for our lot. We talk about him growing up, about what he went through after his huge rise to stardom, and I think the experiences he went through. This is a really fun chat, by the way. It's I think you'll see what I mean. We have a nice, very, very good time chatting about everything, so do give it a listen. Support us on Patreon if you can to keep the channel on the road so we can do our documentaries and all the rest, or use the supporter function. Please subscribe and leave 5 stars if you feel so willing. And that's me. Listen to Will Young. Well, look at you.
I know. I look like
there
a
he
fat
is.
Berry.
No, you're looking how... I don't think you ever change. I think you always kind of look your handsome self. Consistent. I'd say. That's what I think.
I'm going to take that. Yeah. I'm happy with the way I look.
When I was younger, people actually said I was very flattered when I was a teenager. And they said that I looked a little bit like you. And actually, at the time... I was closeted. So I think they were kind of trying to say, we think you might be gay, like the gay person.
Well, I mean, it's so interesting because, like, saying you're a fan of Will Young is basically like saying was seen as seeing you're gay. Yeah. It was very, I sort of became that kind of thing, but that's a whole other conversation. I like the way I look. I think you're a prettier version of me.
No, that's definitely not true. I am looking quite gay today.
You've got lovely, you've got large Bambi eyes.
Bambi eyes. Goggly.
Good bow and lashes.
They're all right at the moment.
Have you ever had them done?
I'm not gonna comment on that. You'll have to speak via my But I will issue a press release later to clarify.
Why would you not comment on that? I'm going to tell you what I've had done. I've had hair plugs.
Right.
I haven't had my teeth done. And
I did kind of have my teeth done, but only because when I was 11 during drama at high school, they you know those warm-up games they do, and they separate the class into two, and they put treasure in the middle. It wasn't treasure, it was some keys. And then they give you corresponding numbers, and I think mine was 3. And then I went, bam, my tooth into the head of someone called Cam. Blood everywhere. And then I had a dead tooth for much of my adolescence. And I only kind of got it fixed when I was like growing up.
Oh, that's not nice.
Yeah,
I had a brace. I had a gap in my teeth. And I had a brace that they used to tighten twice a day for like a year. And it was cemented into my top thing. And that was very nice. And then, by the way, I'm sorry, I've been ill, so I'm sounding a bit...
You sound great. You sound great. I was going to say, I had the same thing.
The last week. Did you? Did you have one of those? And then they wanted to break my jaw because they didn't like me. Because I've got an overbite and a side bite. So they were going to break my jaw and fix it. And... my mum said, do you really want to go through all that pain for something basically aesthetic? And I was like, no, not really.
Yeah, I just think keep breaking jaws to an absolute minimum. That's just a life piece of advice I abide by. I have to say that I had a piece of gum. This is all getting quite, this is now a dentistry themed show. I had a bit of gum there because I had a massive gap between my teeth. And it stopped it closing. So I had to have a general anaesthetic to have that removed, and then I could have the brace there.
There you go, you see. We forget about all these horrors in our past.
Speaking of which, so Well, we're very, 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 very honoured to have you. And I was going to say, because you are a part of I'm now what's called an old millennial, but there's a certain word, geriatric millennial. I'm a geriatric millennial. That's what we're called.
How old are you?
I'm 36 and I was born in 1984. And you were a big deal for, I was still closeted when you came out, but for young queer people of that period in particular, big deal. Now, we'll talk about your book, To Be a Gay Man.
Mm.
It's not a handbook. I should have brought my... It's over there. Well, I might get it at the end.
I forget. When it's people I like talking to, I always just think it's a chat. I'm just going to do this.
Yeah, go on. It is a chat, though. Oh, hello. Yeah. But just for those listening to the podcast, Will was just giving the camera a little white. Oh, that's much better.
Yes, look.
Now whatever was smeared all over the camera has been...
It's probably spittle from a Zoom call.
Where Will is getting very, very intense. Of aggro. Will is associated, of course, with aggression, popular in the public. Should we start with a cliche? The cliche, this is often what happens for those who are of a heterosexual persuasion, nothing wrong with that, is when often LGBTQ people sit down, maybe for a day or something like that, they often go like, when did you know? Kind of thing, don't they? It's kind of, when did you know you were different? I always think is a good way of doing it. When do you know you're different? So when, should we start with that? Because I know you talked about fancying Bobby Ewing, I think it was on Dallas. It was, for me, it was David Duchovny in The X-Files, just FYI.
That's a good one.
It was a good one. He was really hot, actually. What was, I pretended I fancied, of course, Scully. What was your experiences then? Come and talk about, you know, gender norms, knowing you just were different.
Yeah, Bobby Ewing was one, because I sort of fancied him, you know, little crushes. I had to wear sort of like national health glasses, and I had a lisp. I still have a lisp now, and if I think about it, it comes out more. My knees knocked together when I ran. And I liked sort of reading from a young age. And I was very sensitive and it was very easy to cry. And my brother and sister used to call me girl, which really upset me. Isn't that interesting? As a boy, it was like the worst. It was like, you're a girl. Oh, no, I'm not. So I think I felt like other. And I was a big thinker and would sit and think a lot. And enjoy it, you know, sort of need that time. So I think probably from about the age of sort of five, I knew 4 or 5. Yeah.
That is early, I have to say. I mean, very early. I mean, did you have that sense? I mean, I remember thinking back, I mean, we all approach these things very differently, but probably, you know, from the age of 12 onwards, I was like, but I didn't come out to myself for many years after that. I mean, you have to come out to yourself first. Did you have a sense of panic? Because I think, isn't there that sense if you grow up in a straight world where you have this image of how your life is going to pan out and you're going to settle down with a wife and have kids, snatched away, gone, what then? No roadmap.
God, you're so right. This is why you're so right. Yeah, big panic. And I think that set in from a young age and made me feel, you know, probably as I got a bit older, so probably more like around sort of like 11, 12 maybe, but also AIDS and HIV came in, you know, and so I would be witness to these adverts of this, what was called a gay plague, not on the adverts, but that's what it was called. You know, so... Yes, the roadmap was not there. You know, I was not going to marry Jessica Hambury, who was my girlfriend when I was 6. And I was like, okay, I'm a sinner because then I'm in Bible classes and, you know, there's Sodom and Gomorrah and turning to pillars of salt. So that's going into my blotting. You know, your brain is like blotting paper as you're growing up, sponge, taking it all in. I'm a sinner, so I'm not going to heaven, so I'm going to hell. I'm evil, effectively. I'm going to die anyway because I'm going to get AIDS, so I'll die young. And I'll probably never come out. So that's not nice. So I'm in a sort of helpless position of sort of like limbo, almost like purgatory, which many, many gay men were and maybe still are, you know, in a sort of purgatory. The Kenneth Williams living with his mother, you know, Charles Hawtrey, maybe not so much him. Larry Grayson, you know, the gay man that's funny but isn't sexual. So, yeah, I think there was a lot of panic, which probably denoted a sort of freeze response and a deep sense of hopelessness. Yeah. Which is really interesting to look back on, because I don't feel that now. But there's something, it's funny when I say those kind of things, because people are like, oh my God, how awful. And it's like, what's amazing is I did, and so many queer people that have grown up in a heteronormative society, patriarchal society, they fucking get through it. Mm-hmm. You know, living with those awful feelings, and they bloody survive and get through it. Quite amazing.
It is odd, isn't it? I mean, that, you know, that sense, some particular, you know, younger gay people, not just younger gay people, but, and certainly more so then, but still many feel this now, of, if I come out, I'll never be happy. You know, I remember thinking, I mean, I don't know if you ever got these kind of like weird lifeboat moments, or like something you read or a snippet of something you see on television, which is like, that is now my life raft. So for example, I remember watching on daytime television, and I must have been like 14, and some gay man, he's probably like on This Morning or something like that. And he was like, you know, when I was a teenager and I thought I was gay, and I thought my life was over and I'd never be happy. And it was like, and that didn't happen. Obviously, I'm really happy now. But it is true. That's how it can feel, doesn't it? It feels like, you know, you'll be lonely. It's no life. I think that's a cliche, actually, some people used to say about being gay, didn't they?
That's really interesting. Yeah. And it was because again, someone at the door.
Oh, that's someone at the door. Ignore.
Amazon. No, it's interesting because I did pick up things from what I would hear from my parents, you know, and there would be little snippets like, oh, that's so-and-so's brother. Yes, he's gay. But no one ever talks about that. Or, you know, and I'd look at them, I'd be at a wedding or something, and I'd see so-and-so's brother and think, there was always a sense of sadness that surrounded anyone that was gay. Although she's never married. We've always wondered, you know, and there was always a sadness. They didn't have children. They wouldn't have an open partner at any of those events that me as a child would sort of, you know, have access to. Weddings, kind of big, you know, family parties. And there was a sense of being an outcast and not being happy. They're not happy people, you know, and we don't talk about it. My grandmother was like, all her friends were gay. We don't talk about it, you know, and that's so my sense of what a gay man was, because there was no reference, no life raft moments, you know, as you say, beautifully say, on TV. Apart from disgust at people like Julian Clary saying, you know, I've just been fisted by Norman Lamont. One of the best sayings, I think, ever.
If anyone's never seen this clip, go on YouTube after this. Don't stop listening or watching this. But do Julian Clary. It's just Julian Clary at the, I can't remember.
It was the TV awards or something like that.
Norman Lamont, Julian Clary.
Yeah. But, you know, people like him, you know, then would be discussions about them, you know, dirty puffs on TV. And so my only form of reference was, maybe what I would, stuff I've said already. And then that gay men were just very sad, insular, lonely, isolated people. Interesting.
I mean, I remember I did this, this was always an ambition of mine growing up, to be on like I Love 1990s. And I did this show, and I remember that.
Hey, all those.
You know, where you're talking head. Love it. But They made us watch Panorama from 1997, and it had this. It was it was called The Gay Agenda. Hilarious. But they had this Labour MP who was obviously very homophobic in his working men's club, and they just interviewed people. And one of them, this guy, was like, "Do you know what? If my son was a murderer or a rapist, I'd forgive him. But if he were gay, I wish he were dead." And you kind of watch that and think, "Wow, gay people watch that."
Yeah, what a fucking thing. I mean, shit me. What a thing to see. It's very interesting. And it's very interesting writing the book as someone that has worked through gay shame and really realizing. I remember when I did women's studies at university, so it was my fourth choice, my fourth option. Basically, I didn't want to do it. And I got it. And I was like, oh my God, I'm a posh white gay man. And I walked into the room and my tutor, who was amazing, was breastfeed, had short hair, DM boots, and was breastfeeding her child. I thought, we are not going to get on. I was very close-minded. One of the best things I ever did, became a feminist and challenged the patriarchal society, didn't even know about it, and was challenging all these things around me. And that I use that as an example because that writing the book, I was looking at forensically every lesson, everything that I was taking in from day dot. And I was like, wow, fuck me. That is difficult. You did really well to get through that. You know, because being gay, for me, I also realized it's not sexual when you're five, you know, not a crush on Bobby Ewing, but, you know, it's more than that. And I realized there's a lot more to being gay. I was a gay young boy, you know, and I loved pony books and I loved fashion. I loved my mum's fashion. I was sensitive. I read, you know, all those things. And it's amazing that I got through it, actually.
I mean, this book, by the way, everyone must read this book. It is a beautifully written, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant book, which I will keep plugging. You talked about, you know, those looking for gay sexual experiences on television or the internet. And I think when I was 14, Queer as Folk came out, which was like gay sex on TV. This Life, people often forget This Life was a brilliant drama in the mid-90s. One of the first shows to have gay sex on television in a mainstream drama. But I remember as well, look, when we got the internet, you had the modem, bidong, 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 and looking up, gay pornography. And then suddenly you'd be, an image would go, dum, dum.
Yeah,
and
your
mum try ringing someone when you're on the internet, and she suddenly hear her go, do, 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 and then, hello, hello, when you're, anyway. What, tell me about those experiences.
Oh, God. Well, you know, what's so funny, I was watching something last night, and they were dialing up, it was based in, whenever it was, and they were dialing up on the internet, and I heard that, and literally I was like, triggered, triggered. So I used to go into the spare room, used to be my sister's room, still covered in Cure pictures, and the ironing room. And there was the internet on this one big computer, and I used to go in when everyone was asleep, put towels, hello Domino, the dog's come in, say hello.
Hello, are you okay?
Yes. I love you. We'd put towels over the modem to cover the noise of the look up pictures of gay porn and sometimes find a video. But it was absolutely terrifying. I masturbated in fear, I think.
a tradition which continued to this day. So joking.
And I remember writing about that in the book. I think because that was a way that I came across gay sex, basically. You know, okay, maybe it's not. Well, no, actually, it is what it is, isn't it? You always look, well, everyone looks at porn when they're, well, lots of people do when they're teenagers. I had no access to it. The other thing I used to do, I then found a shop in Victoria Station, Victoria Tube Station. I think I write about this in the book. And I saw gay pornography on the top shelf. So I plucked up courage to go in there, buy the gay pornography, and then randomly like some polo mints. Why? And would then get the train back down to the countryside, to my family home, look at the porn, wank in the train loo, and then terrified, shove the porn in the bin in the loo, and then get off at, you know, Hungerford and get picked up by my parents. But there was a lot of terror surrounding it still. And I thought that everyone was looking at me in the shop and that they were disgusted with me. You know, a lot of inner disgust leading to a lot of projection that people were noticing it, you know. So it was experiencing it, my sexuality, but not in a nice, pure way, in a very scared, frightened way. Yeah.
So, I mean, coming out for lots of people, particularly in that age, it wasn't a different era. Well, it was a different era, but it wasn't different complete, you know, it wasn't that long ago. And that's the point I was going to make, actually, because, you know, coming out is, and people talk about sometimes coming out as one moment, an event, but it's actually having to come out lots of different times. And that's without being in the public domain. Now, you were on Pop Idol, and this was such a big cultural moment. It was huge. Everyone was obsessed with it. And it was you, it was Gareth Gates, and it was just this big, big, not clash, but it was the big kind of competition.
Yeah, yeah.
It was huge. But just tell me about that, because in the 90s, people, I think, do look back at the 90s. And I think sometimes, without going down this road, sometimes people look at like old Friends episodes who are like young millennials or Generation Z and go, the stuff they say about gay people and like trans people is really off. Like the butt of the joke is often, oh my God, are you actually secretly gay? You know, stuff like that. But actually, you know, people think of the 90s as this liberal utopian. It wasn't. I mean, the British Social Attitude Survey showed that the year after you came out, so this is after you had come out, 40% of Britons thought being gay was wrong, and just 37% thought it was not wrong at all. So even when, you know, in the early 2000s, people, social attitudes on gay people were still very, very divided indeed.
Wow.
So just tell me what that was like, you knowing you're gay, you're now suddenly being thrust into the, you know, the show. What am I going to do? Do I come out? Do I not? Just tell me what that was like, that whole period.
Well, I didn't know that statistic. I wish I'd put that in my book. It would have been another way of setting a context of the time. Well, there's a few things. I think one when one's living in a time, you know, you don't. I didn't have the space to sit back and go, oh, this is a bit wrong. It was just what it was. So yes, it was a very prejudiced, unpleasant time to be gay. And for some reason, because I had come out at university my first year, for some reason, even though I wasn't happy, and probably I wasn't happy in myself still as a gay man, I was damned if I was going to lie and live in secret. I don't know where that kind of tenacity and strength came from. Probably my parents are quite anti-establishment, and I'm quite anti-establishment and don't like the system. So part of that was probably like, yeah, fuck you all. I was just damned if I was going to go in. So I wasn't scared about what it might do. I was asked during the show to not talk about it. And I got very cross with the then, you know, because I had a politics degree. I had lived a life. I traveled through Africa. Money didn't impress me because I came from an affluent family. So all those things that people could use, power, you know, ooh, these people are giving you a free thing, didn't impress me. It was just there for the singing. And I wanted to win, and I was going to win, and I was going to have a career. I'd had a period of depression already at university. I'd lost a very close family friend. So I'd had experiences. And so I wasn't scared of these people. So they couldn't sort of corral me. And when they said, don't talk about it, I went off on one and was like, no, absolutely not. How dare you? If someone asks me outright, I will say, you know, I didn't go through that period at university, which was hard, to then what? Go backwards. So I was quite kind of stubborn about it. And I'd made a decision that if people didn't want to like my music because I was gay, then I didn't want them listening to my music anyway. And I'll just go on and do another career. So it was weird, but I think I was quite stubborn about the whole thing. Yeah.
Tell me about, you know, you these threats to be outed. You had this awful graffiti. I think it was graffiti. Tell me about that.
Yes. Yeah, well, that was awful. Yeah. I mean, once I did come out publicly, I was always going to do it. My manager, Simon Fuller, was brilliant. Didn't give a shit about me being gay. And we were going to do it through a broadsheet because we thought it would be an interesting way of doing it. Sort of slightly desensationalize it and also take, you know, chop the head of the beast off, so to speak, because of course people knew I was gay because I was out at university. There were moments of threats during the show. There's one really particularly unpleasant man who used to work at a magazine. I won't even grace him with his name, but he piped down. And and then it was the Sunday Mail. We're going to run it. So we, in the end, I think we went with, I can't remember who went with, News of the World, Sun maybe. Blah, blah, blah. And then, yeah, I would get nasty things said. You know, I remember graffiti on a, there was a platform when we did the Pop Idol tour. It was a very big arena tour. And there was a platform that would rise up. And so as the, we'd get on the platform underneath the stage, and on the walls, someone had written faggot. And that same day I'd been in a cafe, and I remember some teenager girl, this was very interesting actually. She's a teenager. She just shoved the phone in my face and said, speak to my mother. And I said, oh yeah, rather not, if that's all right. I'm just getting a sandwich, but send my love, you know. And as I got to the door, it's one of my favorite cafes I used to go to. She said, oh, is it because I'm a girl? Because it had just come out that I was gay. And I was quite shocked by that. It was quite a thing to say. You know, homophobia from a girl, woman, has a different edge to it. It's more surprising and it's almost more cruel. And I turned around, you know, it's one of my moments, and went, no, it's because you're fucking rude. Not, I was quite pleased with myself about that. But no, there were nasty things. Horrible articles written by women, actually, again, you know, basically sort of saying I was part of a sort of gay abusive bullying ring at school. And I never sued the people because I was too scared of the papers. And it's one of my sadnesses that I didn't, because it really hurt me. Yeah, that wasn't very nice. So it would happen. It would happen occasionally. But again, it was just the way it was then. There was no sense of like justice. That's how gay people were treated. And my whole point about the book is because I was famous, it gives a sort of extra microscopic look at how gay men were treated. It's not I'm special. It's like, look at what happened. You know, look what was written about us. But there was no sense of recourse to justice, or just was what it was. Yeah, crazy, really.
Did you have gay people at the time saying to you, thank you so much, you coming out, that makes a difference, that kind of thing?
I did.
You feel an obligation, not that you should do, by the way, but kind of like, I am now a gay person in the public domain.
I didn't, but I did. I remember, I mean, you know, also like, you know, I was just a student, just come out of university. And I remember getting flowers from Elton and David.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
I never spoke to him about that. I suppose it was quite a moment for them to see someone come out from the beginning of their career. And I remember thinking, how the hell do they know my address? But then it's Elton. He's probably listening now. And that was kind of amazing. And I did get lovely letters. And I still get lovely letters and messages. And that's really cool. I mean, that's really got nothing to do with me. I just like potted about. And if it allowed someone, I was probably like quite an accessible gay man. You know, I was fairly kind of neutered in my sexuality then. So I think I probably offered a lot of people. They were like, it's all right. I might end up like Will Young. You know, there was a bit of that. He's like, he's nice. You can take him home to your mum. So, and for a while, I was quite ashamed of that because I thought, oh, nice, Will Young. God, how boring. But actually, now I look back, I think, well, there's worse things to be said about me than nice.
Actually, personally, I found it helpful when you came out. So thanks, selfishly. Yeah. Just on Elton John, do you think it's worth it? Well, yeah. Cheers, actually. Elton John, I think, because I think the way he's sometimes portrayed in the public domain is so different from him. And I just, as an example, because he's very caring, I think, particularly to LGBTQ people in the public eye in some form. When I walked out of Sky News in 2016 after the Orlando massacre, I'm not going to go into that again. But it was certainly a moment. But I got all these. My phone went ridiculous. But I kept getting this number, and it was just like a random number over and over again. And I just thought it was a local radio station. And then I picked up. He was like, "Hey, it's Elton." It was just really random, and he was just there just to be really sweet, really supportive.
He's super cool. He's super cool. And he's got an amazing maternal instinct about him. And we're not friends. However, I know that if I ever had a problem, he'd be there in a heartbeat. And he listens to everyone's music. He knows it all. He would have heard my new songs. He's a fan of music and he celebrates people, and that's so lovely. And it was probably, I tell you who else was nice, was Robbie Williams. He was really nice, you know, but I think maybe I needed that. It was nice to have that little bit of support. Not that I was looking or feeling necessarily like bombarded, but it was a crazy time. Yeah.
One of the things I'm interested in, and I actually spoke about this with you a few years ago, is about, I call this how homophobia is a form of gender policing. So obviously if you're queer, you're the main victims of homophobia, shouldn't need to be said. But in general, like growing up, and you touched on this whole kind of when, you know, being called a girl, that kind of thing. But a lot of homophobia is actually about being seen to betray what it is to be a man. So for straight men are often the receiving end. So if they're not sporty enough, they don't get into fights enough, they don't talk about women in a leering, degrading way. It's like, oh, you gay or something, or worse, are you a puff? It's just quite interesting, isn't it, that a lot of it is driven by this sense of a very obviously one-dimensional and harsh and intolerant interpretation of being a man. And it's almost like a baton to beat anyone who kind of steps out of that.
yes, it was used as a, well, I think you said once, and I hope, or I wonder if I even quote you in the book as saying, the people that suffer most from homophobia are young straight men, you know, that they get, you know, if you're not sporty, like you said, or perhaps you like theatre or, you know, anything other than wanting to play football and, like, you know, yeah, leer at women, then, oh, you're gay is used as the worst form of insult. It's interesting. So I wonder if, I was thinking about sort of school days, and I was saying that, you know, is it gender stereotyping, or is it still that to be gay is the worst, is the most, you know, worst thing that can happen to a child and then to their parents and their family? So, for example, let's say there's a girl that's, you know, I'm just going to make it up, wins the shot put over the boys at school, if they have shot put, you know, or there's the boy that all the parents are watching, age 7 at sports day, and he's way behind all the other boys and girls in winning the running race. You know, that there's a sort of instant sense of that's unspoken, that is like, wow, they're displaying signs of possibly being gay, and you know what, and that is the worst. And I think that parents have a huge responsibility to look at their own prejudices and fears of having children who might be anything other than the gender norm. Because they're terrified that their children or their child is going to be gay. And I think there's still a lot of parents that are like that. Now, they might be terrified because to be gay was, you know, to live a life of isolation and sadness. And, you know, they might be terrified because it'll bring shame on their family. They might be just downright prejudiced and horrible people. But I still think it happens a lot. I still think the undercurrent is, if they're displaying those signs, Johnny really likes theatre. He's very good, isn't he? You know, I don't. So what I'm saying is I think that to be gay is still seen as an awful thing for, you know, to happen to a child. And so if you're displaying anything other than gender norms, that's the kind of end result, is that, I think. Coinciding with that, trying to prescribe children into going along this kind of tractor beam of gender norms is just so damaging to them. And there's been a lot of, you know, conversation about that, I'd say, over the last 10, 15 years. So I really hope that that isn't happening as much. And I don't think it is. But I don't think that the sense of, my God, they might end up being actually gay has gone as much as people would say it has.
And you can tell a bit because even lot, I don't want to be shame people for this, because these are often people, this is a society where people live, but you get like straight men who'd be like, yeah, gay rights the way, rah, rah, rah. But if someone were like, oh, I thought you were gay, they would be actually quite offended and upset. And like, they'd be like, what?
Oh, yeah, I can see it. There's some people that I see near a friend of mine. And it's a sort of house of lads. And I can just see it with some of the lads that live there. I can just see it. And I can see that one of them has a problem with me, that because he's so uncomfortable. I can just tell you, I don't know if you have it, but you can just, I can just tell that he has a real problem with me being gay. Because it'll be something in him. And I don't have a problem with that, because I don't know what that thing could be. It could be anything. So I respect that. But it's got a certain quality to it that, as a gay man, I think you pick up instantly. And also listen to that instinct. Don't second guess yourself. But it's difficult for straight men, you know? It's really difficult, because they're like, what the fuck can I do? Okay, obviously, you know, they grow up in a patriarchal society. But, you know, it is difficult. I would not want to be a straight man. My God, like, it's not easy. Don't show your emotions. Don't, you know, invest in yourself internally and look at your workings, and don't accept your sexuality as a straight man, you know. Succeed, you know, all those kind of things. Look a certain way. It's a lot more now, I think. Followed America with, like, for men now, you just see so many gymmed up men. I'm like, what are we, LA? Do you know what I mean? I mean, I do live in Clapham, but, you know, I think it's a thing for straight guys, body shaming, massive. So I don't think it's easy at all.
In terms of just a couple of other things that I'm really interested in, and I mean, I thought this watching It's a Sin, and obviously this was a brilliant drama by typically the genius of Russell T Davies about the horrors of the HIV AIDS.
Lord Russell.
Lord Russell, indeed, who came down from LGBTQ heaven one day to bless us all. It's a Sin, and one of the things it did, and for those who haven't watched it, a bit weird, but do watch it, by the way, is it obviously the horrors of the HIV AIDS endemic and pandemic in this country and what it did to gay, bisexual community. But what it, I think, showed is how LGBTQ people are damaged by often not just society, but by their parents. And there's always this idea of parents know best, that kind of thing. And that LGBTQ people end up being this substitute family that have to pick up the pieces. Because if we look at mental health, mental trauma is far higher amongst LGBTQ people than the rest of society. And with that comes often abusive self-medication. So levels of alcohol and drug misuse are significantly higher, much higher actually, amongst LGBTQ people.
Yes, yeah.
And often all of us have had experiences with, I'm sure, with other having to look after LGBTQ people who frankly did not get the acceptance that an affirmation they should have got from their parents. And that was like a ticking time bomb that was implanted in them. And one day it just goes off. Do you feel that you know, you get people that damage, people feel it in different ways. Some cope, some don't. And all the LGBTQ people are there as a family to pick it up.
I don't know if I relate to the parent thing.
Oh, not my parents, I should say. Sorry. Yeah. I don't mean my parents. I mean
other
people's parents.
Yeah, yeah, no. And you were referencing It's a Sin. And so I, you know, completely got that. I will have it on the record now. Your parents are fabulous. Never met them, but look what they've produced.
You know, they did the best.
Yeah. Couldn't have gone that wrong. We won't go down the Philip Larkin route. I think there's so much from what you just said that I'd love to unpack. I think I love, you know, that sort of idea of an LGBT, you know, Q+ family and people acting as family because that's beautiful. I think it might be a little bit rose-tinted. I don't know if I necessarily feel that. Some of that in the past might be my own internalized homophobia. So I'd love it if that was the case, but I don't know if I've lived in that kind of bubble of like, it's okay because I've got my gay brothers and sisters, you know. But I do kind of feel it. For example, I met someone recently on the street. I was just talking because I stand outside my house pretending to water my plants, but because I'm a nosy bitch, I talk to everyone that goes past. And I live alone, what can I say? And this girl walked past, she's got the most amazing tattoos, and we started talking about her and her girlfriend. And when I found out she was gay, I just had an instant sort of melting, because I did feel like, okay, yeah, I get you. And that's beautiful. So in that sense, I feel a sense of family and connection and safety, so important. I think in terms of mental health, listen, how can you not, if you're not feeling safe in school, you're not feeling safe at home, the messages you're getting are constantly, you're wrong. I mean, and if you look for transgender people, it is horrific, particularly now, still. You are I do believe that internalized shame is a huge drive towards people having, you know, LGBTQ plus people having problems with addiction, problems with mental health, and all those kind of things that then happen. And so, of course, there's a correlating rise in, if you see the numbers, in suicide attempts, you know, in addiction problems, people going towards all sorts of things, chemsex, it's become worse and worse. You know, it just makes sense. Because if you grow up feeling wrong and defunct, and that you really are just not even worth any sort of value because of your sexuality, that is going to take its toll. And it doesn't go. When I read The Velvet Rage when I was 32, you know, it was really interesting because it was like, it doesn't go. I took really good bits from the books and from the book, and other bits I didn't like, you know, I didn't take. But one of the things I thought was a bit of an aha moment for me was, just because you've come out doesn't mean all that shame's been dealt with. You've got a backlog. So what happens is people come out, they go into a world, find their queer family, but, you know, it doesn't mean they've dealt with their internalized homophobia, their internalized shame, and that then comes and bites you in the ass later on, and it certainly did with me. You know, it did. I was watching too much porn. I was buying too much, spending too much because I could. You know, I was probably drinking too much. Never really had a problem with drugs. Probably smoking too much. And then other addictive things that we have, like thought addiction. You know, we all get all go into loops of thought. No one ever talks about that. Behavioral patterns that are forms of addiction. So I certainly had that. And I think, yeah, probably a lot of it was driven by shame, not feeling good enough. Mm. Yeah.
Just finally, but actually, just I'll ask a final roundup question. But you mentioned trans.
Never had Botox.
So say that again.
I've never had Botox. It's all just me.
And do you know what? You look, you have the same, what starts as a curse but ends as a blessing, which is youthful, eternal youth.
Well, my mother, I must say, I mean, I don't like seeing my mug next to you because you look like a little cherub. You're a cross between a cherub and Bambi, and I'll hear no more about him. But my mother and my grandmother, very youthful. My mum drives around, she's 68, and she drives around in a Japanese supercar. And I think she's got about 5 tattoos now. She's very upset Glastonbury's not happening. I mean, she's so cool. She can also be a nightmare, but I kind of love her for that. She's quite an inspiration.
She sounds like an icon.
She kind of is a bit of an icon, but she's got a problem because, I mean, people do think she's the local drug dealer.
I'm sure she's unbelievably proud of you.
I doubt it. Go on. I think
trans people, I'm really interested in the parallels there because the way gay people, and I mean, it's not gone away, but traditionally in the media, in the 80s in particular, a lot of the 90s, it was gay people are potential sexual predators. Gay people are going to brainwash children, which is why Section 28 was, of course, introduced. It was biology is destiny. God made Adam and Eve. He didn't make Adam and Steve. It was that it was a mental illness. It was that we were some sort of weird fetish. It was that why should the majority have to redefine who they are because of the whims of a tiny minority? All of these things are being played out again, don't you think? About trans people, it's exactly the same tunes all over again.
Exactly the same tunes. I was driving along in London, and I saw a trans woman. First of all, I thought school kids were shouting at me because I used to get a lot of abuse from school kids. It's quite sad, isn't it? But anyway. You know, young lads. It's like, oh, fuck off. And then I saw her, I can't remember her name. And I pulled up round the corner and I stopped because I saw some police. And I said, look, I just want to let you know, this person. And I suddenly realized she was on her way back from work. It's like, and, you know, schools were breaking up, end of the day. She must walk past that school every day, how many days a year, and get that abuse every day, every morning. And actually, I stopped and I spoke to her, and the police did. They were amazing, by the way. She was like, it happens every morning, it happens every day, 5 days a week, how many weeks in the year? And I just was like, it makes me feel really sad, actually. And I also feel I had so much admiration for her. Because I just thought, how do you manage that? I mean, I managed it. But, you know, I'd also had the protection of chauffeur-driven cars and being famous. Being famous is a bit of a trump card because in the end you sort of win. I took on a guy in a gym once. He was on his phone. He was a tosser. He was on his phone talking really loudly. And I was like, I'll just fuck off. And he's like, oh, money, money, money. He was like 28 and he was quite blokey. And I said, is there any chance you could speak outside? And he kind of squared up to me. But then I saw he recognized me and I thought, being famous top trumps. You're not going to hit me because you'll get in the papers and you lose your job. Do you know what I mean? But this woman, I think they get it so badly. And it's not something that I can understand. I don't walk in their shoes, but yeah, it's horrific, horrific. And I don't really get, it's just fear, isn't it? People are scared and it'll calm down, but yeah, it's not good. It's a long-winded way of saying you're completely right in what you've just said. Yeah, what's going to happen? What do you think will happen? Do you think it's going to? Is it moving in the right direction?
I think what I would say, and obviously this, I need to be careful of the lane that I'm in because it's not my lane. And I know talking to trans people, trans friends of mine, a lot of them are like, we just want to leave the country now, really? Kind of looking for their passports, kind of. Moment, but I would say that I'm without going darkest before it's dawn, you know, the section 28, which was introduced in 1988, which banned the so-called promotion of homosexuality in schools above all else, that was the first homophobic legislation introduced in this country for generations. So I suppose if you were going to be really depressed at the time, you would look at that. And in the 80s, attitudes, according to the annual British Social Attitude Survey, towards gay people got worse and worse every single year throughout the 1980s, until in 1988, two-thirds of the population thought being gay was wrong and about 11% thought it wasn't. And I think what I'd say is often when a civil rights movement or a minority makes strides, they get a very intense backlash, which can feel overwhelming and horrific. And what gives me hope about the current moment is, if you look at the polling, attitudes towards trans people are far, far more favourable than they were towards cis, that's people who aren't trans, gay people and bisexual people in the 1980s, like a lot more. And the most pro-trans, as you would expect, are women by a very long margin, which is why when people say it's an attack on women, it doesn't make any sense, because the polling shows it's men who have the biggest problem with trans rights and trans people. And younger women are the most pro-trans rights, and older men, not all older men, I know, but older men tend to be the most transphobic. And I think what that shows is it's generational-wise, younger people take trans rights as an article of faith for lots of people, in a way that even me as a old millennial, my section of that generation didn't when we were teenagers at all. I didn't stand trans rights at all when I was a teenager. And I had to be educated by trans people. So I think, again, I need to be careful. It's not my lane. But I think, of course, they're going to win. I mean, trans people will win. Trans rights will be won. And trans people will be accepted as equal members of society who will be able to flourish and live happy lives. The issue is the trauma in the period going up to that. And there will be times when things feel like they are going backwards, which they do at the moment. But that's what happened with gay people as well. And in the end, we'll all win. The issue is how much damage and trauma is going to be inflicted on human beings along the way. And that's what's horrific. It's obvious how the story ends, but it that doesn't airbrush out the horrible suffering that's going to be there.
No, what's going on in that during that journey? Yeah, I mean, you said something, and I just wanted to.
I was going to ask a final question.
My dog started snoring, and it sort of slightly took me off balance.
Oh, it's quite. I always found cats when they start snoring, I found it quite reassuring about it.
But he can sound like a fucking freight train.
Yeah, ours don't. Ours is just like.
No, cats are gorgeous. They're gorgeous.
Oh, they are. They're very sweet. Do check them out on Instagram. Nice little plug. Instagram.com/OwenJones84.
Range coming up.
Yeah, exactly. They are very. People do stop me in the street and ask me about my cats. They are socialist celebrity cats. Final question. What if you had to go back to your younger self when you were closeted? What do you think the main thing you would tell yourself about being gay that you would have liked to have known if
this is like chair work I used to do with my therapist, Lois Evans, who famously said to me, if I was your boyfriend, I'd dump you.
Rude.
Amazing. She also said, see these Tiffany earrings? When on our last session, because we finished, forever, we'd done the work. She went, you pay for those. amazing woman. What would I say, or how would I? It's interesting because you saying that question brings up some sadness in me, you know, which clearly shows that, you know, it's still there and probably always going to be there, a sense of how difficult it was, you know, for me as a young boy, you know, feeling quite isolated. I'd take him to like exhibitions and say, you can read as many pony books as you want. Probably buy him a She-Ra model. Yeah. And outwardly encourage the fact that he was given an extra He-Man, and the He-Man, they used to go out with each other.
Cute.
How cute's that?
That's very cute.
Yeah, that's what I'd do. Yeah. He was quite a sweet little kid, actually.
You know what? Well, you carried on being a cute adult kid. That's a bit of a weird thing to say. Your cuteness has persisted. Now it just sounds like really weird flirtation on to wrap things up.
It's all right. It's all right. I know your partner. It's all fine. It's appropriate.
He doesn't exist.
He's gone. Cat's ate him.
He does, but he's protected. So it's a big, big honour, Will. That was absolutely brilliant. And I have to say to everyone, the book, To Be a Gay Man, is brilliant. It is so wonderfully written. It's moving. It's insightful. It doesn't matter if you're heterosexual. We've got nothing against you. You will get a huge amount from it, and you will learn a huge amount. I learned a huge amount, and I think Will's humanity and fun sort of oozed out in this interview, and it oozes out in the book. It oozes. I'm not sure about the word ooze.
No, ooze is good. Ooze. Yeah, because you don't want to write stuff. There's nothing worse than earnestness, is there? Earnestness is so boring. So I use comedy in a deliberate way, because otherwise it's a whole book of very dull things, you know. And also, life's fucking funny, you know. Life is really funny. A postman came up to me last week and went, God, you've put on weight. And that's funny.
Rude. You're looking great.
It's funny.
Yeah, it's okay. It can be funny, depending
on... Funny things can happen, but also a lot of sad, hard things happen. So, you know, that's life really, isn't it?
You could almost say that life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
I can't believe, honestly, I've really enjoyed talking to you, but you've now just said that, and I just think, what the fuck?
It's a great film. It's a great film. It is a great film. I comfort watch it sometimes.
Do you?
Well, not for a while. I don't think I've seen it for like 5 years, but
I comfort watch Pretty Woman.
Or Bridesmaids. Brilliant comfort watching.
Well, Bridesmaids are the best.
We watch that a lot with my partner, who we've just discussed. Bridesmaids is a great. It's just, I tried watching it, making my mum watch it. Didn't work at all. She was like,
oh, she loves it. But I think it's brilliantly written as well, because you've got that thing of how friends pretend to be happy for other friends. That's what's genius about it. She's like, I'm getting married. And the best friend's like, I'm not really happy. You know, she's not happy for her at all. And so often friends, I say to my friends, when my friend got engaged, I can see the clock, so it's like an hour's up. Like being on live radio. When my friend got engaged, I actually owned my shit. And I said to her, I'm so happy for you. I said, I'm also really envious, and I'm unhappy for myself because I'm at the time I was feeling single and sad, and I owned it. She was fucking amazing. She was like, totally get it.
Yeah. I mean, it's someone said, you know, one of my friends, like, you know, whenever one of my friends succeeds, a part of me dies. Before we go, I'm going to just show you Keir. Keir has just arrived, my cat. Beautiful Keir. 1 second, stay there.
Keir. So beautiful.
Call me.
Oh,
hello to Will.
Hello.
He doesn't really want to do it. Oh, come on.
Hello, my darling. Liked me when you met me last time. You wanted to sit on the
table. He was a big fan. I think what he's doing right now is, I don't want to be here. Just put me down. And he's just like, I just have to get through this.
Yeah, I can see. Daddy wants to come.
He is very affectionate, I should say, to anyone who thinks this isn't an affectionate cat, but he's just not in the mood for it. He's just like...
I think that breed also are very affectionate, aren't they? Well, I'm going to show you my dog.
Yes, come on.
Mosquito bites all over my arm. Where are you,
Dominic? For those who can't, obviously, if you're listening to the podcast, Will has a wonderful, beautiful, largely white dog, I would say, with bits of... looks beautiful.
Yeah, he's... I rescued him. He's enormous. Him and his daughter, I think. He still is very bad around other dogs. But the trainer's coming. He's just changed my life. Rescue an animal if you can. That's what I would say, because the bond is very, very special.
So we've got two tasks at the end of this podcast for people: buy To Be a Gay Man and read it, or get the audiobook, or both, and rescue an animal. Those are your two tasks. Go.
Easy. What are you waiting for? You idiots.
Yeah, you clowns, you stupid people. Lots of love, Will. Really appreciate it.
Abuse the audience. It works. It's called negative selling, I think.
Well, we'll leave those bastards. And thank you, Will. Lots of love.
Oh, fuck off.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Hope you enjoyed that. Do support us on Patreon or using the support function to keep the show on the road. And do subscribe. Lots of love. Speak soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.